On this episode of the Simply Recording podcast, Graham talks about recording an entire band with only 8 inputs, and I'll be sharing a quick tip on how to keep up with all the different versions of your mixes. All right, welcome to episode 5 of the Simply Recording podcast. I'm Joe Gilder from homestudiocorner.com.
And I'm Graham Cochran from therecordingrevolution.com.
So it's been a little while, Mr. Cochran. How you been?
I've been good, and I do feel guilty that we haven't had a podcast. We skipped November entirely.
But we were too busy being thankful.
We were. I am thankful that we were busy. That's good.
Yeah. So you've been busy recording your band and putting out a Christmas EP, correct?
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. So we've never done Christmas music before, but last Christmas we were playing some songs at church and I was doing some arrangements of Christmas songs, and we kind of toyed with the idea of, wouldn't it be cool if we could, you know, record some of our own? And then what we wanted to do was tie it into one of our outreach ministries at our church. And so it was kind of like, I wanted to get this EP done so we could, you know, get it out for Thanksgiving, let people enjoy it, and let all the proceeds of it go to one of the ministries at our church. So it's kind of a 2-for-1 thing, but it was kind of like our goal, let's do an EP. And then, you know, we said, well, I don't really know how many songs we could do. And I said, let's just keep it real simple. Let's do 3 songs. And what we wanted to do was actually like record it live, like, you know, all at the same time, because that's not usually how my band records or a lot of people record this. So with no real overdubbing, that was like my goal. Let's go old school with this.
Cool.
Yeah, it was fun. So that's out right now. If you're listening to this podcast, you can definitely check it out. The link will be under the podcast. But it's just 3 songs, and it's going to be real stripped down was the idea. I knew we wouldn't have as many tracks involved, but I just wanted to make it easier on myself because I didn't have time to do a whole, because we're actually about to go in the studio and record some other original music, but I was like, we got to do this quickly, but I want it to be quality, so let's do it real simple, fewer tracks, it'll be quicker to mix, that kind of stuff.
Cool. Well, we'll get into that a little more in depth here in the main segment. That'll be kind of what we're talking about, but otherwise, we're glad you're here as a part of the podcast. If you're new to the podcast, you can head over to simplyrecordingpodcast.com, leave a comment, let us know about you, any questions you might have. We'd love to interact with you there, and obviously at our respective websites too. So both of us have been busy putting out lots of articles and videos, so make sure you check all that stuff out. And without further ado, let's jump into the main segment.
So today what we want to talk about is recording your whole band with only 8 inputs. The number 8 isn't really that important as much as it is maybe a common number of inputs on a decent audio interface, so it might be familiar to many of you, but this would be opposed to recording and overdubbing your band maybe one instrument at a time. So you might be familiar with getting your drummer in there, miking up the kit, recording to a click track and some scratch tracks, using maybe all the available inputs you have. Maybe you have 8 inputs, 8 mic pre's. And once you got the drums, then you can get the bass player in there, you can get your guitar and keyboard players, you can lay down vocals, and over the course of days, weeks, months, however long it takes you to record, you're slowly adding a piece to the puzzle, and eventually you've got all your tracks recorded. And that's a very wonderful way to work, especially for home studio people when we don't have a big space or a great sounding space to record everybody at once. But what I did recently, as we mentioned at the beginning of this segment, is I wanted to record my band using only 8 inputs. We have 4 people in our band, and that was the challenge. Can we track a full drum set, bass, 2 guitars, and vocals with only 8 inputs in one room at the same time and have it sound good? Because we still wanted to release something that was quality that people would enjoy and would be willing to pay for so that we could raise money for our ministry. And we didn't want to just make a demo. We wanted it to be top-notch. But this was something that was some of a challenge for me personally to want to do.
So what led you to want to do this? Was it more of a time constraint? Or was it simply you wanted a new challenge?
Both. It was both. I knew we needed to record this EP, and I didn't have much time because we couldn't even get started till the fall. And I needed it to be out in the fall. And
because you don't typically release a Christmas EP in like February.
Right.
Right.
Okay. If you want to sell any of them.
Right.
You know, there's that window where everyone all of a sudden loves Christmas music and they remember how great it is. So yeah, that was a time constraint to one degree, but really I think, you know me, I love limitations. I love setting myself up to say, okay, you can only work under these circumstances. It kind of, I don't know, I kind of get excited about that. And that was something that in the back of my mind for the last couple of years, I said, when I get a chance, let's do a project when it's on my own time and not somebody else's, where I can literally just do it live, real minimal, so we could do it quickly and see what happens. Because I don't normally track that way. So yeah, it was a challenge mostly.
Do you feel like you got a more musical response out of the musicians, since you're all used to playing together live, but probably not in the studio? Do you feel like that allowed you to probably get a little more emotion and a little more musical feel out of the performance?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, if you listen to this recording and then maybe listen to other recordings that we do, and if I listen to them, maybe I can't tell, like, oh, this one definitely has emotion and this one doesn't. Mm-hmm. Because all the guys are playing their butts off, even when it's just them and they're focusing on their part. But I think anecdotally, in that moment, when we were sitting in a circle facing each other, and I can see Speedy, our drummer, across the room, and he can see me as I'm singing and getting into it, and our bass player is right there, and our lead guitar player is ripping on the solo, and we kind of can feel that energy that we're used to live. It kind of makes everybody, you know, play with that special something. So I think it was there anecdotally. And what really happened was everyone was really kind of secretly nervous about it because they, you know, we had to get it right,
yeah.
You know? And the way we did it is we did take two full takes of every song.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so it wasn't like this was going to be the only take as if it was like a live show. But in essence, our goal was, you know, make sure we're rehearsed. And we rehearsed as if it were a show. Like, we need to know our parts because we don't have much time. And I think everyone was just a little nervous. And I think that nervous energy caused them to just buckle down and just deliver some of their best performances. It's cool.
So you essentially set up all these different parameters and limitations to add some pressure to both you as the engineer to get it to sound good. Also, you and the rest of the guys as musicians, there's that added pressure that
totally.
If you're prepared, like if you're prepared, you know what you need to do on the recording side, and if you're prepared musically, then it's really not a bad thing at all. All pressure isn't bad. It's just a matter of how you respond to it. And you know, like they say, the best athletes always perform really well, you know, fourth and inches, you know, with 3 minutes left to go in the game, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
You know, I think it's the same deal. If there's a lot of preparation that went in beforehand, you know what you're going to do. There's no reason it shouldn't be awesome.
Exactly. Yeah. And then, you know, that's something that is missing in a lot of modern recording is the secret benefit of like some pressure. Like, hey, we actually have to be talented musicians that have practiced and not only our instrument, but practice playing with each other, meaning we know how to listen well to each other. We can feel each other's dynamic and we know the song inside and out so that when we go into the studio, quote unquote, we're ready to deliver something excellent. And I know that I get lazy at times when I don't have to do that because I can multitrack, and I'm not knocking that style of recording because that's how I record all the time and professionally. But there was something that I felt like I wanted to tap into, like if this were the 1950s and we're just going to get in a room and we're just going to play, you know, we're just going to record music. And mm-hmm. the moment of like, wow, these microphones are actually capturing a performance was kind of exciting to me. So it was part of the experiment is yes, we were pressured in a healthy way, and it squoze out of us, I think, really good performance. And on the engineering side, which is a lot of what we're going to talk about today, is I have to think differently about microphone choice and placement, and I don't have as many options. And it made me think differently because I'm not used to recording all the time in that live environment.
Very cool. Last night I went to Presonus had a kind of an invitation-only event at Ben Folds' studio here in Nashville, which is the old RCA Studio A. So big, ginormous tracking room we were set up in. And just being in that room, we didn't do any recording, but it just had this feel. Like I could see the control room off in the end of the room, and there's this just, you could fit a whole orchestra in this room. And just thinking about setting up a drums over here and the bass player over here and guitarist over here, just all in this one room and just rocking out. It's definitely inspiring and kind of triggers a different part of your brain that you don't do when you're multi-tracking everything. So even if you're not a musician yourself, which I know a lot of our readers and listeners are also musicians, but some of you may just be engineers, and that's great. Keep that in mind when you're working with bands. They may not think that recording at the same time would be a good idea, but it's worth giving it a shot or at least having that conversation. Because like you said, Graham, I was just listening to that EP you just put out, and it sounds great. Like I don't listen to it and say, oh, it's live, so it's, you know, I got to listen with different ears. I mean, it sounds good.
Mm-hmm.
And
oh, I appreciate
a lot of that
yeah.
was the pressure you put on yourself. So kudos to that. So let's talk more technical stuff.
Yeah.
Why don't you walk us through what those 8 inputs were and mm-hmm. kind of your decision process for, obviously you had to start prioritizing because you couldn't put 7 mics on the drum kit because everybody else
and
doesn't
for everybody
recorded.
Else.
Right. So what'd
sure.
How'd you go through it and what was your thought process?
Sure. Well, yeah, what we decided to do was, let's start with drums. We used 3 mics on the drum kit. So I decided I wanted a stereo image of the drums, so I wanted 2 overhead mics. Mm-hmm. And we used the Recorder Man mic placement technique. So there's 1 overhead mic directly above his snare drum, you know, so maybe he's sitting at the snare and it's like right above his head looking down at the snare drum. Mm-hmm. And then there's another mic off his right shoulder looking down towards maybe the beater side of the kick drum. You know, it's kind of looking past the low tom. So that's, you know, there's information on the web and on some of our sites about that, but they're both mics are the same distance from the kick and the snare. And so you get a nice, focused, punchy stereo drum sound. And the only thing that's really missing from it is kick drum. Not a lot of low end.
Yeah.
So we put a 3rd mic right outside the kick drum in the front so we could have at least something that I could be getting more of that air from the kick drum, and also so I could compress and EQ that separately just to get some bottom. So that's what we did with drums, was 3.
What mics did you use?
We used, for the overheads, a pair of Kell Audio HM1s. Mm-hmm. So they're basically, technically a mid-diaphragm microphone, so it's like it looks like a small vocal microphone.
Okay.
So we use those for the overheads. They're real neutral. I really like, they don't have a lot of like top end boost. So they just kind of pick up a real natural sounding kit, nothing fancy. And then the kick drum, we actually used a Behringer B1, $100 vocal mic.
It's a condenser mic, right?
It's a condenser okay. mic, and it has a pad on it. And that was helpful because we were getting a lot of air hitting that mic. So that was maybe a foot away from the kick drum.
Mm-hmm.
And we kind of covered it with a blanket. So we had like 2 chairs flanking the kick drum outside. Mm-hmm. If you can picture that in a blanket,
yep.
kind of going over the, just to get a little separation from the kick
so
mic being outside.
Kind of a little cave for the kick.
Yeah, it made a little cave. Yeah, exactly. Looked really ugly. And so if you see the video, if we post the video here, it just looks, you can't even see the
if
microphone.
It's not ugly, you're not doing it right.
Yeah, we were using our drummer's shoes to hold up the kick drum microphone stand because it was imbalanced because the mic was too heavy.
That's awesome.
It looked really ugly. So yeah, 3 mics on the drums, overheads and a kick drum mic.
So you mentioned in your thought process, you wanted to obviously be able to compress the kick drum, but because it's all live and there's going to be more bleed, you had to take some things in consideration because in an empty room with just drums, you compress and it just compresses the sound and everything's great. When everybody else is playing, then as you compress, it brings up the sound of the room, which is going to be the sound of the guitarist and the bass player and singing across the room. So you got to you can't go all crazy with compression on a live recording because it just ends up bringing everything else louder.
Yeah,
that's a
precisely
good thing to think about.
So if you know you're going to record something live, the name of the game is separation, right? Is what kind of separation can we get just to maximize your flexibility later, because you don't have a lot of flexibility. So that was a little move that helped us, is like, let's at least separate the kick drum out a little bit. And what we try to do is put the drummer in one corner of the room with his back to, you know, to a corner as far away from everybody else
right.
as we could, given our small living room, dining room combo that we were recording in.
And did you do anything? Okay, we've got the tent or the cave over the kick. Did you do anything else as far as baffling to try to block out some of his drum sound from the rest of the room, or did you realize it's a drum kit? It's not gonna really matter.
We tried. For the electric guitar, let's say, okay, so that's a 4th input, our electric guitar player. We put his amp down the hall in a kitchen. So,
okay.
You know, he's running a cable, so his amp at least is far away, facing a different way. So there was some separation naturally between, so the drums aren't bleeding in his mic and his guitar amp isn't too loud around the drum kit. So that was helpful just to get it far away.
Sure.
And you can do that right with an amp. the bass guitar, and so yeah, that was mic'd up with a 57. It's the amp. It had an SM57 from Shure. The bass guitar we ran direct right into the interface, so he could stand anywhere right next to the drummer, which is nice. And then the big challenge was I played acoustic guitar for two of the songs, mm-hmm. and that's the challenge in the vocals, right?
Right.
So I'm sitting right across from this drum kit. So we did try to use some baffling on the behind the microphone that was pointing at the acoustic guitar. It's a little bit of foam, some Oralex stuff that can just slap like a little baffle that can go on a mic stand, but that didn't do much.
Right.
You know, I did what I could because I had it.
Right.
But at the end of the day, you're right, like it's a drum kit. So what we had to do originally, it was just killing us how loud the drums were. And so I had to tell our drummer to play with brushes for two of three songs. Mm-hmm. So if you're familiar with playing with brushes instead of normal drumsticks, it definitely changes the sound of the drums. And that's what he was not happy about. He didn't like it when I brought that up. But it reduces the volume tremendously.
Yeah.
And so that affected even the vibe. We got two of the three songs, you know, the sound is brushes hitting the kit and not sticks. And so the toms don't ring the same. And it was another compromise. That's the other name of the game is compromise.
Which is, we could spend all day talking about that, especially in a live setup. But the drummer may not have liked it, but it turned out to be better. He could have had his way and just played with sticks, but then the vocal sounds like a drum kit. So I'm guessing the vocal's fairly important.
Yeah, I mean, you know, of course I'm the vocalist, so I'm going to say
and the
I think the vocals are very important. you know, and any engineer who's smart knows that the vocals need to be there, but everything needs to be there, and I don't want to compromise his sound because I want the vocals to work. So some of that was in the moment we're saying, hey, this is just too loud. And so for one of the songs, when I didn't play acoustic guitar and I had an amp down another hall mm-hmm. and I played electric, I said, go ahead and play with the sticks. And it was more of an aggressive rock sound anyway, so he kind of had to. And we just dealt with it. But here was the thing, though. You talk about vocals. In the moment, we were originally recording with a typical condenser mic for my vocals, but mm-hmm. it's too sensitive and it was picking up the drums tremendously all around. So we switched to an SM57 for the vocals, so a dynamic mic. Mm-hmm. And that cut down on just a ton of volume of the, it just was a lot more focused right on my face. It mm-hmm. didn't pick up anything. But so that helped out a ton. But even then, at the end of the day, when we came back and I'm opening up the tracks in the studio and I'm going to listen to them, I had to overdub some of the vocals not because the vocals sounded bad with the SM57, but because of the drum bleed
uh-huh.
in my vocal mic made the drums sound bad.
Does
that make sense?
The sound of the drums in your vocal mic with that processing blended with the real drums made the real drums sound bad.
Yeah, exactly. It was like, I was thinking, man, did our drums really sound that bad? And then when I mute my vocal mic, the drums come to life.
Mm-hmm.
So I was like, no. So we did mic the drums well, even with three mics, but it's the bleed in my vocal mic that is killing our drum sound, even though my vocals sounded fine.
Right.
So a lot of those tracks I had to overdub. You know, so technically it wasn't all tracked live in that sense because it was killing the drums completely.
And
so
I'm assuming if you put like a gate on the vocal, that just sounds weird because...
Yeah, it would like change. It'd come in and come out. I know, I tried. I really did try. So that it wasn't, you know, it's not perfect. And I think I did a blog post about it and I mentioned I overdubbed some of the vocals. Sure. There's some other things we overdubbed too, but that just goes to show like... It's really, really hard when it comes to the vocals, but everything else really worked. You didn't need that many inputs. So yeah, here's the other thing. You mentioned inputs. So drums had three.
Okay.
Bass was four.
Okay.
Electric was five.
So we got
my vocal is six. So we got two inputs left. There's my acoustic guitar was mic'd, and then I also ran the direct output of my acoustic electric. And that was helpful because even though the internal pickup doesn't sound nearly as natural as a mic in front of it, I knew that, you know, if I turn up the acoustic guitar mic in the mix, I'm just going to get more drums and more vocals. So this way I had an acoustic sound that was mostly acoustic, and I kind of could fudge my way to getting the right acoustic level. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Cool for like if an intro to the song where the drums aren't playing, then you can use the mic.
Yeah.
And then once the drums kick in, you can probably crossfade those back more to the direct signal which you're not going to notice as being direct as much when the full band's playing, right?
Exactly, because you're still going to get the percussive strumming element of it. Yeah, so that was new to me too, because I don't like the sound, even with a good guitar. I don't really like the sound of, you know, unless it's, you know, you have to and it's live. But that really saved the day. So if you have an acoustic electric and you're doing that, and if you have the input, that's why I say I was going to do 4 mics on the drum kit, but I was like, I really need an extra input for this acoustic direct. Mm-hmm. So that's another compromise.
So you sacrificed snare drum mic for acoustic.
Exactly. Player. Exactly.
Very cool. And back to the vocal thing, you probably could have, once you started and sang a few, you know, practice takes and listened to the vocal, you probably would have realized, okay, there's a lot of drums here. You could have just said, let's just track all the instruments and then I'll just come back and overdub the vocals, which is essentially what you did anyway. But I'm guessing the performance, everybody performs better when they've got a singer up there singing and then doing a full band performance. Is that kind of the thought process behind it?
Well, you know, there was no thought process. Way it turned out. Yeah, I wasn't that smart to think it through. I really was trying in my mind to get the vocals there.
Right.
In the back of my mind, I said, I am not planning on overdubbing any vocals. So I came prepared to sing. I kept my voice in shape, and I was trying at the same time as we played to sing my butt off as if this were the final take. And it didn't end up being that way for a lot of the vocals. So yes, in essence, it was like we just showed up to track the band minus the vocals. But man, did me singing help.
Yeah.
Because it was like we were playing the songs. And not just for even knowing where we are in the song, but it was just, I think I played the guitar better because I was singing while I played, you know? So there's that vibe. It affected the way I played and everyone else played. So it still had its impact.
And I would guess you don't think of it as a failure that you had to go back and overdub. I mean, if anything, there's still some vocal bleed from the original vocal and the drum mics and stuff that adds that kind of a vibe.
Oh, it's there, yeah.
Too.
If you listen,
yeah,
man, especially like the last track is Silent Night, and it starts out with just acoustic guitar and my vocal. And if you listen closely, it almost sounds like there's a double effect on my vocal because you're hearing my overdub vocal back at the studio, then you're also hearing my vocal bleed in the acoustic guitar mic that was right down by my stomach.
I didn't think about that,
So that, you know, my vocal is in the acoustic. So it's kind of there and it's kind of weird and vibey. I mean, it's subtle. I mean, you may not even notice it, but yeah, it's part of the vibe. I didn't feel bad having to overdub. I guess I was more surprised at how well everything else turned out.
Right.
You know, that the rest of it was salvageable.
Yeah. So did you, I meant to ask about the acoustic. Did you try to mic that fairly closely or closer than you would normally just to cut down some of the bleed?
Yeah, I did. You know, maybe I'd like to be a foot or two away from the mic.
Right.
You know, in the studio, but I was like probably 6 inches away.
Yeah.
You know, and then I try to compensate by getting it further from the sound hole so it wouldn't be too boomy. Mm-hmm. So yeah, we experimented.
Sure.
We spent, to give you some perspective, we show up at this house with our gear like 8:30 in the morning, and by lunchtime we hadn't recorded anything, even with only a couple of inputs, because we had to change placement of where we were sitting, we had to swap in and out mics and make compromises and things like that. So we were still experimenting with, can we get a usable sound, you know, and everything affects everything else.
Yeah, and I think just what's so neat about this is there's compromises all over the place, but it's not as if you're compromising the recording itself, if that makes sense. You're making some compromises here. You didn't have 20 mics to choose from, so you picked the perfect mic for everything. You had whatever mics you brought, you know?
Right.
And you put, it'd be nice to maybe have a dynamic on the kick, but it sounds like there wasn't one available, so you put the condenser in. It turned out fine. You just use what you've got and make it sound good, and I think that's what we talk about this all the time, but what a lot of people would hold off on having that session until they had all the exact pieces of gear. You know, they had the whichever that Audix D, was it D3, D6, D5, you know, for the kick, and wait till they had the match pair of condensers for the overheads and the perfect vocal mic. And just, and in the meantime, the rest of us are making music, you know, it's so easy to get caught in that trap, but it like you proved, made a great recording, had good musicians, and used whatever gear you had. I like it.
Absolutely. I agree. And, you know, there's someone in a whole nother context that I've always heard this concept that there's like the 85% rule. Like, if you can get yourself 85% of the way there, you're doing great.
Mm-hmm.
Like, if you're holding out till everything's going to be 100% perfect, like you just said, Joe, you won't get anything done. So if you want to make music in our context, whether you're an engineer that wants to have the right setup so you can record professionally, and you feel like you don't have enough equipment to be professional, or if it's just your band and you want your music obviously to be excellent, so you don't want to rush into your album until you're ready. But if you hold off till everything's 100% or 99% ready, you're missing the point, because 85% of the way there is great. It's better than 0%, you know. And
I would imagine you as an engineer and your band as a band, you guys are another notch better because of this one day recording project, as opposed to you could have said, well, we just don't have the gear for it. Let's just not do it. And like I always say, the more projects you finish, like start to finish, work through all the challenges and actually finish something, you learn so much more than just sitting around waiting for the perfect storm of everything working perfectly. And, you know, any recording project, even high budget stuff, there's always weird issues, and whether it's a time constraint, they've got to get it done by a deadline, or they're, you know, issues at the studio, gear's not working, there's always going to be problems. But if as long as you can,
I couldn't agree
more.
Have
the guts to work through it. Just finish something.
I think you're right, dude.
I like it. Well, cool. Well, any final thoughts on that process or anything else for those of us who are, even me, I've got a project I'm working on. I was just going to overdub everything, but now I want to at least do bass and guitar at the same time, just for the sake of it, because it's fun. I want to try it.
Yeah. Well, you know, I think the only thing I would say is it can be really exciting to blend the two, because that's what we ended up doing. We tracked everything as a band, and we made it our goal to get it all down. But at the end of even in that moment, after we recorded the songs that day, we did some overdubs with all of us singing into one mic, some, you know, what you call gang vocals or something. And we all just threw up a mic and we overdubbed a few of those. So we'd have this, and we're in this room with hardwood floors, just a living room. And so it would just sound like a bunch of guys sitting in a house singing these Christmas carols together, you know? Mm-hmm. And I thought that was really cool. And so we did some overdubbing there, and maybe some clap tracks we did there. But when I came back, I got to blend that live, organic, raw, simple vibe that we did in the actual day of recording. I blended that with a couple of virtual instruments and Pro Tools, like, you know, some vibraphone, a little bit of a string patch here. I overdubbed one extra guitar part that it felt like it needed, the smallest of things. So it was a blend of live and then also thinking in your studio what you can do. And so I feel like it together, it was a really nice compilation of two schools of thought. And the result is something that has that vibe that you can't recreate very well individually, but at the same time, it doesn't sound too raw. It can have enough polish on it.
Yeah.
That's acceptable, you know, and people enjoy it and listen to it.
Yeah. Very cool hybrid approach.
Like just the way it ended up being. So it's something you should, if you're listening to this and you want to try it, my whole goal with doing this originally was not only to prove it to myself, but to prove to everyone out there that, you know, if you have 8 inputs, man, you can do a whole band right now. Like, you could do it right now. You know, you don't need anything crazy. So if you can do that, then you can do more with more inputs or more time or what have you. But I think it should encourage people to just don't be held back. And like you said, Joe, just get out there and finish a project and see what comes out.
And the worst thing that can happen is it just doesn't work.
Yeah.
But you'd at least learn something, right? You learned that the vocal didn't work, but you got everything else good and overdubbed the rest. It was wonderful.
Thank you.
Oh. You're welcome. Well, before we get too much more sappiness, let's jump over to the quick tip.
I agree.
For today's quick tip, I want to share with you a way that I go about keeping track of all the different versions of my mixes that saves me time and hassle when going through a mix project. I was mixing a couple different projects for a couple different clients just in the last month or two. And typically with a mix project, you're going to do your initial mix, send it off to them, and they come back with some notes and revisions they want you to do. And usually, if you're doing your job right, it's not really tonal things they want you to change. It's more just level balance things. For example, one, I had the background vocals kind of buried in the mix, just nice and quiet, kind of like a pad. Turns out they wanted them to be almost as loud as the lead vocal and more of this choral type sound in the song. It was just a stylistic thing that I went one way and they decided they wanted it another way. Not a big deal. So I go and do a revision, bump up those vocals, do whatever else they wanted, send them off a new mix, they come back with any other changes, and you go through that process. So usually, hopefully, just one or two changes if you did your job well. But if you start getting where you're doing a couple, they want you to try some different things, and you're sending, you know, 3 or 4 different types of mixes, it starts to get real easy to confuse, to lose track of those mixes and where they are. And so the way that I do, when I do a bounce of a mix in Pro Tools, instead of using bounce to disk, I actually record everything to disk. So all my tracks are running through an aux bus. It's kind of like my master mix bus. And when I'm ready to do a bounce, I just change the output of that one bus that one aux track to a new bus and actually record that onto a stereo track at the very bottom of my session. So the first mix, I'll name that track song name mix one, and I'll record it right there. So now it's right there in the session. I can go solo that track and listen to the mix and make sure it's everything I need it to be. And then I can just simply use a key command to export that file as an MP3 or whatever I want, send it to the client. Come back and do another revision, I can go in and just create a new playlist on that same stereo track at the bottom of my session and name that song title Mix 2 and record my mix there, Mix 3, Mix 4, whatever, however many it takes. And if I'm getting a little confused as to which mix is sounding better, or I just want to refer back to a previous mix, all I have to do is go to that track, solo it, and click on the playlist button and go pick which version I want to listen to. And immediately, while I'm in Pro Tools, without having to leave and go to iTunes or go to my hard drive or anywhere else, I can listen to what that mix sounds like and do some comparisons right off the bat. I can even compare a previous mix to the current mix that is playing in Pro Tools by just toggling between the two. So that's a pretty helpful tip that keeps me sane when I'm mixing.
I like sanity, especially in the studio. So I like that tip. So tell me, so Joe, because a lot of times I'm doing bounce to disc. Mm-hmm. When you do record to disc regularly, are you recording it, keeping it at a 24-bit file in your session?
Yeah, because it's the session's already at 24-bit. It's just recording to a stereo track. So everything's the same as the session itself. And then I just export it out as an MP3, usually for reviewing it.
Yeah,
and then
yeah,
export
definitely.
It out as the 24-bit wave if it's going to mastering, or 16-bit, I guess, if I'm just mastering it right there.
Gotcha. Okay, so this is a question then relating, I was going to ask you about mastering. Do you like to put a limiter on your master bus to kind of get a reference volume level for your mixes?
I do. And it so gets when me you, in trouble, but I do.
No, I understand. I mean, so I'm assuming, let's picture this, you've got that limiter on your bus, and then when you record to disk this mix, it's going to be the limited version, right?
Yes.
So that you couldn't actually export that out even for mastering, because it's you'd have to re-record it out.
Correct.
Without the limiter, right?
I'll go ahead and record it with the limiter, so when I send it to the client, they're not coming back and saying, well, it's too quiet.
It's too quiet,
that's
yeah,
not the point.
Definitely.
Just listen to it at roughly the volume you'd expect it to be mm-hmm. at. For one of these projects, I wasn't going to be mastering it, so I sent them the limited versions. Once they signed off on the final version, I did a new bounce with the limiter off with just the straight uncompressed file, and then that's what I sent to the mastering house.
Cool.
So, yeah.
And did you record that to disc also and then export
recorded
it
that out? To disc as, you know, all caps final mix or something. So I've got them all right there.
And that keeps all your mixes in your audio file folder, right?
Exactly. So if
in a session.
It's not a separate folder, even within the session folder. It's all in the session.
That makes sense.
Pretty helpful.
I like it.
Cool. Well, that's a quick tip.
Well, that about wraps it for episode 5 of the Simply Recording Podcast. This is Graham from TheRecordingRevolution.com.
And this is Joe from HomeStudioCorner.com.
And we appreciate you guys hanging out with us today. And hey, if you guys want to grab a copy of that Christmas EP, I will plug it one last time. Go to www.alethiatampa.com. That's A-L-E-T-H-E-I-A, alethiatampa.com/Christmas. And you can stream a sample of all 3 songs there. And if you want, for $3, you can download it. It's a MP3. You'll get the album art. And then all that money's going to feed families this Christmas here in the Tampa area. So you'll be helping our local community out, but you can enjoy some music as well. So definitely check that out. And I think we'll probably post here on the site a link to the video of us recording, so you can get a glimpse of what we did with our kind of ghetto setup of recording live to 8 inputs. But
it's
yeah.
a cool video. We'll have it. It's about a 5-minute video where he's in the space showing you all the stuff we talked about today.
Totally. We appreciate it, guys. Thanks for tuning in, and we'll see you on a future episode.